I'd like to suggest that we start in prayer where we left off, but we not read anything. I'd like us to simply sort of pray our t-shirts and our summer theme. Love before the foundation of the world and apply it to ourselves. So that's kind of where we arrived yesterday. And so if we could just be in silence and feel ourselves being loved before the foundation of the world. So simply taking some silence, let yourself feel, you know, if you can't really get there to be being loved that way, just as if you were loved before the foundation. Still with our eyes closed and our concentration on feeling love before the foundation of the world, just notice, if you would, in a little bit more silence, if the silence has brought up ways in which you are objecting to thinking of yourself that way, and just acknowledge them. And now once more, let the love before the foundation of the world be felt in you. Amen. Okay, so I promised the first 10 minutes on the thing I didn't get to yesterday. I was so tempted to just break my promise because I've got so many other things I want to talk about. But some of you said maybe you would read the Gospel of Truth overnight. So not to put you on the spot, but if there was someone, there are some folks who did read the Gospel of Truth overnight, and you have some thoughts or questions, we'll take them now.
I read it, but my only question is, and I may have missed it yesterday because it was a little late, where did it come from? Where did they find it?
Yeah, thank you. So the Gospel of Truth is again from the Nag Hammadi jar, this jar found in the hills of central Egypt by two farmers in 1945. So it's one of the really big bundle of documents that were found at the same place. And I didn't give you the whole Gospel of Truth. It's hard enough to understand. I thought I'd just give you about two-thirds of it. We'll probably be able to come back to it this week, but I want to just hook it up with what we were talking about yesterday in John. And for those of you who have a copy in hand, or I think there's some extra copies over here, I've handed out the other things that we're going to do today, so don't confuse them. I'm going to read out loud from the from page 232, and I know the numbering here. This numbering came actually from the galleys of my book, not the the actual, because we thought this sounded too much like a football signal, 23-17-10. That's where I'm going to be reading, 23-17-10. That, for your information, that represents the column of the ancient manuscript, the verse of the ancient manuscript, and the chapter that we made up. So So just remembering about the way the Gospel of John wove together the idea of wisdom or Sophia at the beginning of the world and the Word at the beginning of the world. So here's from the Gospel of Truth. His wisdom meditates on the Word, and his teaching speaks it. His knowledge reveals it, and his patience is a crown upon it. The it here could be translated him or her given the wisdom and Word stuff. But it's mostly about the Word. His joy is in harmony with the Word, and his glory has exalted the Word. His manner has revealed it, and his rest has received the Word. His love made a body for the Word, and his trust has embraced it. In this way, the Word of the Father walks in creation. I just love these last two verses. In this way, the Word of the Father walks in creation as the fruit of his heart and the face of his love. The Word bears all things and chooses all things, and the Word receives the face of all things and purifies them, bringing them back to the Father, to the Mother, Jesus of boundless sweetness. Now, just to say that if you, one of the things that is off-putting about the Gospel of Truth, I don't know whether you were off-put or attracted, it is by far the most sensuous language in all of early Christianity. It just overflows with a sense of the sensuous relationship between the Son and the Father and wisdom and the Word. In a place that I won't read, it basically asks the question, so who are humans? And its definition of what it means to be human is to be the fragrance of God. To be human is to be the fragrance of God. In other words, you cannot find a bad word about humans in the entire book, but rather just lush images spilling over and over again about the tender relationship between God and people. I'll just read one other page. This is on page 235 in the section called the Parable of the Sheep, but there are no sheep in this, what I'm going to read. This is to us, the readers. Say then, from the heart, that you are the perfect day, and within you dwells the light that never ends. Since we don't hear that very often, let me read it again. Say then from the heart that you are the perfect day, and within you dwells the light that never ends. Speak of the truth with those who seek it, and of knowledge with those who have sinned through their transgression. Strengthen the feet of those who stumble, and stretch your hands to those who are weak. Feed those who are hungry, and give rest to the weary. Raise those who wish to arise, and awaken those who sleep. For you all are understanding drawn forth. Okay, so that's the gospel we're not going to talk about today. But we may be able to sort of hook it up. I mean, that was meant to be taught. We meant to talk about it yesterday, and we just got too interested in John. So we may be able to hook it back in tomorrow or Thursday. But so today I want to pick up on John and hook it up with the Thunder Perfect Mind, which you have copies of. But I first want to do two things. I talk about two things and a little bit of John. So this word midrash, I kept wanting to talk about it, but of course, obviously, I had messed up my time enough yesterday that I wanted to notice. You know how we noticed that the Word of God in John 1 was philosophy from the Greeks. It was Genesis from the First Testament, and it was Proverbs 8 in wisdom and God being together at the beginning. So, in other words, this writing wanted to kind of put together those stories. So it had the vocabulary of Greek creation stories. It had the vocabulary of Genesis creation story, the first creation story in the beginning, and it had the plot of Proverbs 8 of God and another divine being together creating at the beginning of the world. So just to say that this is just what many peoples, but especially well-known were the Jewish people of this time, is they liked retelling their stories, and the verb for midrash, for those of us who like it, that is mixing up stories and putting them into a new one. They liked to drash stories. They liked them to take two or three stories and put them together, add some stuff that made those stories better for the time that they were writing. So that's midrash. The next term I want to use is one that if you ever want to show off as a biblical scholar, you can. Otherwise, I think it's a useless word. Eratology is the technical term for an ancient speech of a divine being who proclaims how great he or she is. I mean, these speeches are all over the Mediterranean. Probably the most famous of them are based in the about the goddess Isis in Egypt first, but as many of you may know, Isis became very popular. For instance, Isis was way more popular than Jesus for the first two centuries of the Jesus stuff in the Mediterranean. So Isis is really famous for giving long speeches about how powerful and great and good and beautiful she is. But actually, there are all kinds of divine beings that are saying that. We bumped into two yesterday, right? In the Bible. Remember Wisdom herself and her, that I don't know how much you noticed about that in as I was reading it, but she brags for the entire chapter 8. And that's, you need to know that she also does that in chapter 1 and 4 and 7 of Proverbs. She simply keeps saying how great she is, how powerful she is. This is simply not new stuff for the ancient world. If you got a god, you know that she or he is going to just tell you how great they are. And we have just barely got to touch this, but the Gospel of John does the same thing. It's the only book in the New Testament that has Jesus saying, I am, all over the place, announcing how he is the bread of life, the good, by the way, the Greek word is really beautiful, the good shepherd, the vine, the way, the truth, and the life, the resurrection, the living water, the sun, are just some of the times in which Jesus says, I am. By the way, of course, in Exodus, in the Hebrew scriptures, you have that really famous eratological, that God bragging kind of thing, God revealing God's self to Moses as I am who I am. So the I am is really powerful. And by the way, Jesus in the Gospel of John, at the drop of the hat, will say I am. And here's a little bit of interesting Greek that shows you how important Jesus saying the eratological I am, showing who he is and how wonderful he is. So in Greek, the Greek word for I am is this word, eimi. But that's not what you find in the Septuagint of Exodus or in John. Rather, it's way more I. So in John, you don't use the word just, the word that Greek has one word for I am, as a number of languages, some of you know. But John always has the word ego before it. And that is the word for I. So you could say this is kind of a stutter step in John, but it's not that. It is a really emphatic I am. I am. So in other words, we have in the Bible this kind of speech of the divine revealer saying how wonderful and powerful the divine revealer is. Yesterday we discovered something really amazing, though, about John, I think. And that was especially when we were dealing with chapter 17 and being loved before the foundation of the world. In other words, we noticed that the big I am of Jesus is always related to the I am of us. Jesus is always saying, I am in you, and I am in the Father. You are in me, and you are in me, and you belong to the Father. So the I am, Jesus' I am, over and over again translates into our I am. In other words, as we were saying yesterday, we are in God. So I want to just suggest that I am all of these things, when Jesus says it, is an invitation for us to think of ourselves that way too. That we participate in the bread of life, that we participate in the good shepherd. The vine is obvious, right? Because Jesus actually follows up, I am the vine, with you are the branches. So that's the same derivative participation in the divine figure. So we participate in the way, the truth, and the life. We participate in the resurrection, the living water, and the, as John, you may have noticed that in the very first chapter, John says, because of Jesus, we are children of God. We participate in the godness as children. And again, just, we said this yesterday, but let's notice how powerfully blessed this speech is and how different it is than the way that John was often used in later Christianity as a way of saying how great Jesus is and how, therefore, rotten we are. This is intimacy. But, I mean, granted, it's not intimacy quite as sensual as the gospel of truth, but it's real intimacy of identity. I don't know, I just kind of think that I, as a Christian, and most Christian types just don't get enough of noticing this kind of language in the Bible. Any thoughts or questions? Yes?
Particularly when you throw in the concept of resurrection, we always think of that as sometime down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So then for John, really what he's saying, the resurrection is now. And we are a part of that. Eternal life is now. Mm-hmm. We are a part of that. Mm-hmm.
Most scholars will say that John has a realized eschatology, meaning that what you hope for is already here. In fact, in John 14, Jesus says, you know, this intimacy will go on and on between me and you.
I think it's a tragedy that we as a Christian community then do not emphasize that, do not live with that thought in mind.
Mm-hmm. That I feel as if we kind of lost some of our best stuff in losing the intimacy of being in the divine that John keeps saying over and over again. really interesting that John basically never gives you teachings about what you should do. You'll find very few teachings in the entire Gospel of John about what you should do. It's because you're okay just because you are in this intimate divine relationship. Well, yes, so Robin.
Your definition of erotology,
is yeah.
that pronounced correctly? So you were saying that the other gods, particularly Isis, practiced that. Is there any sense that they also meant to be more inclusive than just themselves?
I don't think so. And we're gonna next make the move into how John is a bit different than the other gods praising themselves. Isis, as she grows older, shall I say, that is, as the world gets bigger, she claims to be relevant to everybody. And it is true that the people who loved Isis most at the time of Jesus were not in Egypt, but in current-day Turkey and Greece and current-day Italy. In other words, it was just a time because the world, the Mediterranean world, had become one under Rome. So people start picking divine figures from somewhere else to celebrate their belonging to a bigger world. That applies to Jesus too. So Jesus is especially attractive because he's not Greek and Roman, and the Greeks and the Romans are saying, hey, we've just discovered that the world is bigger than us. Yes, I've forgotten your name.
It's Daryl.
Daryl.
Just one more follow-up on that. So then, when we speak of ourselves as participating or one with the divine, that's very similar then to the heresy of Jesus, who says he and the Father are one.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Yeah. So that's probably half our problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that our later traditions have said that that's heresy, I think, is the problem. There's not in John, it's just effusive intimacy.
Say that again.
In John, it's just effusive intimacy. It's not worrying about whether this is heresy or not. I mean, John does occasionally call other people heretics, especially in 1 John. Okay, so now we're set up for another erotology, and let's just read a bit of Thunder Perfect Mind out loud. Y'all have a copy? I put piles around. Yeah, I printed 30 of these, and they're still short.
There's one on a
chair. Oh, good. We got a couple. Everybody got one? Great. Okay, because that's a different copy than I have in my book. Okay, let's just sort of read the first chapter here, and I'm going to just kind of see if we can do this as a dramatic. So act like you're a divine being. And I'll say something like, will a woman now read this? Will a man now read this? Let's all read this, all the women, and all the men, and so on. Okay? I'll start out. I was sent out from power. I came to those pondering me, and I was found among those seeking me. Let's all read 2 and 3.
Look at me, all you who contemplate me, audience, hear me. Those expecting me, receive me. Don't chase me from your sight. Don't let your voice or your hearing aid me.
Don't ignore me in any place, any time. Be careful. Do not ignore me. I'll take a woman for the next 3 verses.
I am the first and the last. I am she who is honored and she who is mocked. I am the whore and the holy woman. I am the wife and the virgin. I am he, the mother and the daughter. I am the limbs of my mother. I am a sterile woman, and she has many children. I am she whose wedding is extravagant, and I didn't have a husband.
I am the midwife, and she who is hasn't given birth. I am the comfort of my labor pains. Let's skip down to chapter 2. Someone want to read chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, a man?
I am the silence ever found, and the idea infinitely recalled. I am the voice of countless words and the thousand guises of the word. I am the speaking of my name.
Let's all begin with verse 7 at 7 and 8. I am both awareness and obliviousness. I am humiliation and pride. I am without shame. I am ashamed.
I am security.
Security and I am fear. Yeah, you just want to keep on reading. That's great. Let's read verse 11 through 15. I'll ask a woman to read that. Right after that, read 15.
Pay attention to me, to my impoverishment and to my extravagance. Do not be arrogant to me when I am thrown to the ground. You will find me among the expected. Do not stare at me in the shit pile, leaving me discarded. You will find me in the kingdoms. Do not stare at me when I throw it out among the condemned. Do not laugh at me in the lowest places. Do not throw me down among those slaughtered viciously.
Thank you. All right, let's take a breath. Thunder, there's only one copy of Thunder in the world. It was in the Nag Hammadi jar. People are usually need to take a deep breath after they've started reading it. Just immediate, uncensored impressions.
Can you just clarify, I don't know if I missed it at the beginning, but like what this document is? It's just an ancient text?
It's an ancient text.
Does it have any relationship to other texts we know that's relevant? Or?
I'm going to say that it has a really intense relationship to the Gospel of John.
We know when it's from or wrote it or why it was written or anything like that?
Since it's the only one, we're really still puzzling about it. It was in that Nag Hammadi jar, which we're almost sure was a collection of Christian writing. So the only guess we have is that this is intensely related to one or another Jesus movement. We don't have any quotations from it except from one other piece of another Nag Hammadi document, the Gospel of Truth, in which a couple of these lines are repeated. But frankly, Jesus is not explicitly in it. So we don't know for sure that this is Jesus. We just know that it's been picked up by, or maybe authored by, people who love Jesus. So it's very hard to say. I can say, and I said this a little bit earlier, in the modern world, I mean, this was the first Nag Hammadi book to be grabbed by the public. Toni Morrison, both of her novels, Parade and Jazz, the introduction comes from The Thunder Perfect Mind. Umberto Eco in Foucault's Pendulum has an entire chapter in his novel about The Thunder Perfect Mind. You can find this set to music all over the place. So that doesn't answer your historical question, if you thought I didn't know a lot about who wrote John, I even know less about who wrote Thunder. Other quick impressions, just sort of feeling level?
It's a journey together, mutually exclusive terms.
There's some kind of contrast in the same sentence, isn't there? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Peter?
I'm sorry. It's like the beat poets to me.
Like a beat poet?
Allen Ginsberg.
Okay, Allen
or
Ginsberg.
Howell, or those kind of, you know, where they were kind of rants.
Uh-huh, okay.
What language, was it written in Coptic?
This is in Coptic. We most people think that most Nag Hammadi documents were first written in Greek and then translated into Coptic. My Coptic reading of this shows Coptic poetic devices. So that you couldn't say in Greek. I don't know whether it was written originally in Coptic or Greek.
The Coptic was written around what time period?
Coptic is a language that comes into being at the end of the first and the beginning of the second century in Egypt. Just briefly, it's Egyptian. It's just regular old Egyptian that people are speaking in the first, the end of the first and the beginning of the second century. But you all know, at some level, you forget you know, that Egypt already had a written language, but it was hieroglyphic. It was not alphabetical. So Coptic is the first alphabetized Greek language, or Egyptian language. So basically, you stopped using hieroglyphics, you started using the Greek alphabet, and then you, because there are five sounds that you can't make in the Greek alphabet that you make as an Egyptian, you made up five new alphabet letters. I'm wanting to get to people's feeling level, Kari.
I really like it for its paradoxical quality, that it is like all one thing and all the opposite. I love that. It's like, that's my understanding of God. That's the only way that I can understand God. And so like, this is like right up my alley.
Mm-hmm. I like it too, but it strikes me as like a really long way of saying I am all sides of everything.
Yes, Karen?
I feel that it relates to some of the alchemy art from that time, in that the structure of the stained glass was using geometric symmetry, and so one of the ways that people experienced heaven was using light and geometrics to encompass, try and surround everything. So the symbology would be inversed, upside down, twisted, turned around, but there'd be a perfection and a holiness in the geometrics of it. And there's also some number symbology that was helpful for people at that time. That seemed related to their dependence on the stars. I mean, I'm not trying to get into cosmology, but like Hildegard von Bingen, some of her songs and poetry feels like this to me. So
that would be kind of a resonance even 1,000 years later. Yeah, that,
right, but she had access to Egyptian chemistry before anyone else in the Germanic world.
That's true. Yeah,
and
that's true.
So no one else had, I mean, she just had an Egyptian pilgrim that she knew, I think. I'm just, you know, as a novice, studied it for a while, but I do feel like this has something about it that's, it feels like cosmology, that the macro has a similarity to the micro, and that there's a wondrous beauty in all of that. So it just, I don't know, feels inspired.
I'm gonna come back to you, Peter, in just a minute. So some of you picked up on what readers early in Thunder do pick up on, the kind of opposites and contrasts. It turns out that it's not quite opposites. They're almost always three pairs rather than two, or three, a triplet or a quadruplet rather than a pair, and it's not quite opposite. But it is this profound mixing. So I think, Kari, it was you that stumbled over in chapter 1, verse 6, I am he, the mother. So by the way, this is really gender-bended as well. You notice it's primarily female, and this is just not some tricky modern translation, by the way. It's mostly feminine, but occasionally it will switch back into the masculine. And I am he, the mother, turns out to be just right, because later it turns out in the latter part of this chapter, it is a man who mothers as well. Excuse me?
What did you just say? I'm sorry.
It turns out that I am he, the mother, fits with the later part of this chapter, in that it's a man that mothers in later in this chapter. Now, the other thing that I got you to read, but that I'm not. Let's turn back to chapter 2. And that last part that we were reading, first is a kind of a pay attention to me, to my impoverishment and to my extravagance. And then these next four verses: do not be arrogant to me when I'm thrown to the ground. You'll be find me in the among the expected. Do not stare at me in the shit pile, leaving me discarded. You'll find me in the kingdoms. Do not stare at me when I'm thrown out among the condemned. Do not laugh at me in the lowest places. Do not throw me down among those slaughtered viciously. Notice here that you've actually kind of turned an interesting corner. Now she's mostly not glory. And not strong. So these are generally not pairs that say I'm strong and weak, but she's just slaughtered, thrown down, put in the shit pile. All of those things. There's only one place in Thunder where she says she's only one thing. And that she says, I am a barbarian. Now, this is really interesting, of course, because barbarian is a slur, right? No one would ever say, I'm a barbarian. The barbarian is the word for the one that the civilized people call uncivilized. In other words, there is here something that a divine person of this age would not do, and that is say, I am humiliated. The word I am humiliated occurs four times in this. But then there are all these images of being humiliated. So this is very puzzling. Karen, you were talking about how puzzling this is, but it's puzzling because all of a sudden there is an Isis-like figure who seems crippled, hurt, thrown to the ground, and a barbarian. There's really only one other eratology where the person who is proclaiming their divinity also ends up being hurt. That's the Gospel of John. So remember what happened to Jesus and John? He actually got crucified. Just to say a little bit about crucifixion, I know that we only learn stories about Jesus being crucified, right? What we don't know is that there were hundreds of thousands of people under Rome that were crucified. It was state terror. So what happened is the crucifixion is the biggest humiliation. It's under Roman law, crucifixion is the punishment for trying to participate or for participating in rebelling against the empire. And at lunch we were talking about this, and somebody said, well, what about the two thieves? Well, actually, Rome trumped charges on everybody. They would go into villages and towns and randomly crucify people in the public square so that you would be afraid of them. And so you wouldn't think of rebelling. That might be a pretty good strategy, right? Tell you what, if we think even, or think that you're thinking about revolting against us, tell you what we're going to do. We're going to string you up in a public place, and we're going to watch you die for several days, and then we're going to let the birds and the dogs eat your body. That's what they did. And that's what happens to Jesus. In other words, it's weird that we don't get the crucifixion and how humiliating it is. So what's really interesting for the Gospel of John is that the Gospel of John has the divine intimacy and Jesus proclaiming that, and the one who is proclaiming the divine intimacy of everyone is the most humiliated of all. So for me, I think I know why it's in the jar. It was in the jar. Is that this began to make sense as a way of thinking about what it meant to be in the divine intimacy with Jesus. And that is that it includes all of our humiliations. And it includes all those who are humiliated and considered not civilized. So that's a link of, I've just been trying to say, I wonder why this is so popular now in our culture, the Thunder Perfect Mind, and why was it in the Christian jar? So those are some initial thoughts. But I can tell you, it turns out that mostly kind of non-Christian artists are interested in this. I didn't mention Ridley Scott has made a movie to this text. So it seems like it has some kind of attraction there. Yes, Robin.
I haven't read any other of it, so it may come up in other places, but, you know, a lot of the spectrum of comparison is kind of neutral, but in 16 it says, I myself am compassionate and I am cruel.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Are there other places where...
Where she is, there are two other places where something like that said, yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, don't. Okay. Doesn't fit with my... with the work I've done so far.
Yeah.
It needs to be considered. Okay. Yes, Peter.
You know, all of these, you know, dichotomies, the spectrum that you're talking about are all closely related to sin or virtues and those types of spectrum. And, you know, of course, Jesus came to save us from sin. And so, you know, when you look at pride or you look at humility or even disgrace, you know, these are all spectrums of places people could be in, and maybe it was intended to help people identify with this, that you could be anywhere on that spectrum, and it's talking directly to you.
Mm-hmm. You know, the work that I know that's been done most on Thunder in that regard has to do with women. So, for instance, that first thing, I am the whore and the holy one, she was honored and she was mocked. People are noticing that in the ancient world, maybe the modern world too, women have these dichotomized identities. You're either the holy woman or you're the whore. And that this is trying to basically deconstruct the dichotomization of people who are dishonored in some ways, who either are considered the whore or they have to be the pure and the holy one. So that's I think, is the place where I've noticed folks thinking most about what you're suggesting.
I just thought that it sounds like the, you know, character defects or whatever you want to call sins or whatever. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's to get people to identify because, you know, you're kind of anywhere inside that spectrum, but it's very... open to you, maybe that's the thing that you're coming to Christ with.
And it's really interesting, isn't it, that the Christian, early Christian language does not shy away from talking about prostitutes, but always in a way that makes them included in unexpected ways. So prostitutes, barbarians, and the like, those are the ones that seem to have a natural being drawn towards that, and it seems like that would deconstruct the the label of them as sinful. Okay, so let me just sketch out the rest of the week. So I'm hoping tomorrow to do much more on politics than I've done in the last week and a half relative to the Gospel of John. And there I'm going to be thinking a lot about the vocabulary in John of Jesus as Son of God and Jesus as Lord. Because it turns out that those words, when you use them in the time of Jesus, are mostly used for the emperor of Rome. And so we'll be thinking about that, and then I'll show you both inside the Gospel and in the Secret Revelation to John, which is another newly discovered book, how it seems to be addressing, by knowing who Jesus is, it seems to be mocking imperial power. So we'll start then. Thanks.